Manamana. 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 All right, welcome to the Upstate Carolina Linux Users Group. I'm Jace. I'm going to be presenting the Bash Scripting for Newbies, Part 5. This is a little more than newbie-ish, because we've already discussed many things, so I'm just kind of building upon what we've already learned. But that doesn't mean that all of you have been here. In fact, half of you have not been here before, so at least that I recognize. And this is great. Glad to have y'all with us. I know we've got some visitors from Columbia, right? Are you here for a specific reason, or?
Just to visit.
Okay, great. Great to have you here. Anyone else from out of town? All right, I'll be here all night. So, okay, so let's pick up where we left off. And we were doing frying Shakespeare after frying bacon. So let me teach you a new little filter program utility. We start off with a shebang bin bash. That indicates that the rest of it's going to be interpreted by shell. This little program, it reads the head of Hamlet, Act 3, Scene 1, which head, if you don't give any options otherwise, will do the first 10 lines. The head of the file, in other words. Then I can print echo for a blank line. Then I'm going to do the head again, and then I'm going to pipe it, send it to the output of head to the input of fold. Fold's a new program, a new filter that we're going to be doing that I'm going to be showing you. And what fold does is it, at the width that you give it, it chops it off, puts it on the next line. Okay? That's the remainder. It wraps, basically. It's a line wrapper. You can give it the double dash width equals 40. And with a lot of new programs, it has two different formats. You can use the dash W, the single letter, or you can use a double dash with a word. For documentation purposes, this is better for bash golf. This is less characters, less strokes. Right? So you'll see it both ways. With this, for most programs, you can combine the dash single character options. So, everybody understand what I'm saying? So if fold had like an I and a D and a T and an H option, and I just had a single one, single a dash here, then that would give me all five of these options with the H having a parameter of 40. That's not what I'm doing here. I'm using the double dash with the word width. Did I just confuse everyone? No. Okay. So what this will do is it'll print out the 10 lines, send it to standard out, fold reads it as standard in, and chops it off at column 40, width 40. Then I'll print another new line. I'll do ahead of Hamlet again, the first 10 lines, and send that to another program called format. What that does is similar to fold, where fold takes and just chops it off and wraps it to the next line. Format actually takes it to a word boundary and nicely wraps it and then brings the next line up and then formats that and continues formatting that way. Does that make sense? It'd make more sense if I showed it to you. So let me execute this right quick. And I'll do that by doing this. So you see right here, if you remember, I just, this first part is just the top 10 lines of Hamlet Act 3, Scene 1. And this is column 40. So you see what fold did is it chopped off question to be questio and put in colon on the next line. Then the next line it did, whether it's over in the mind to suffer, and then puts R on the next line. The slings and arrows of the outrageous fort, and then ood on the next line. So you see it just wrapped it and chopped it off and wrapped it. Right, make sense? Now, format, which is what I use on practically a daily basis because I have a little, I use Vim, and so you can use any, you can send a line or a block or an entire file through any other program, like a filter. And I usually do, I usually send it to format. So I say, you know, my page is 75 columns wide, and, you know, I've been typing and it wraps around. Okay, it looks ugly. Type it to format, and it makes it look nicer. So what it does is it took the word to be or not to be, that is the, and then took question, put it on the next line, and then brought up the other line and brought it up, but it says no longer in the. And you see it's right there. Mind, go over here, mind suffer the slings and arrows. Am I over explaining it? You got it, right? Makes sense. So whenever I was writing this little program to do format, and last month we did paste, where you can take the file and another file and you can put it right side by side, I thought, hey, do you know what we could do? Is we could make take a text file and make it like newsprint. So you have two columns, right? Not a lot of usefulness to it, but I thought it would be cool. So I wrote this little program that is the little handouts that I got here. If you want to pass it around.
You can have more than one copy. Just want to take that column.
So, let's see. Newsprint. Okay, it's a long program. So let me just do first couple lines.
Where is it?
Okay. So I'm on the head of newsprint. Start off, it's running bash. Okay? Got a comment? This is just to tell me what this program does. It makes a file read like a newspaper, in other words, in two columns. This is the things I'm introducing today. A comment for me to do at a later point if I ever want to make this a more improved program. Because, you know, I need to read newsprint like articles on my prompt, right? So, okay, first thing I do is I take a variable called debug, and I set it to either true or false. I commented out false because I don't want to do false right now. But right now, I do want to use debugging. That's just something that I created called debug, and I'm setting it to true. See what it does? Let me do that. Let me run it and see what it does. So if I give it, or would you rather go through it and know what it does and then say, hey, it did it, or would you rather see what it does and then analyze it that way?
I can't wait.
Go ahead and run it. All right. It's print. Okay, what's the file name? Hamlet. 3.1. What is the number of columns on this screen? Well, let's see. I think it's probably an 80-column screen. I know it's not, but I'm going to say that. What is the number of lines on the screen? We'll say 30. And there we go. Hot dog. Well, it's not perfect. This should be over here, but it's close enough, right? That's something we need to debug later on. I'm not going to worry about it. So you see what it did? To be or not to be, that is the question, whether it is nowhere in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, blah, 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 blah. The undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns puzzles the will and makes the rather makes us rather bear those ills. So you got what I'm doing, right? I took the file, I made it smaller, I chopped it off, I put it on here, and pasted those together. Alright? Is that cool or what? Is that awesome? Is everyone going to use this program now that they have a printout of it? No, Jace, you're fooling yourself. Okay, so, the first line we did, if I've got parameter, if I don't have a parameter, right, because if number one's the first parameter to the program that I give it, if this is nothing, then I need to ask, here's a new program called Read. What Read does is it prompts you and puts into a variable what you give it. So you saw me run it and say, what is the font? It asked me what is the font name, and I typed in Hamlet 3.1. The dash P is the prompt right here, the prompt parameter. So you can give it a prompt, or otherwise you don't have to have a dash P in there, and it'll just, you just type in something whenever it stops, right? So I put into the variable that I call file. Now notice this does not start with dollar sign, right? This is a parameter that I'm initializing, that I'm assigning to clear. Okay? So now what happens if I see that's what happens if dollar sign one is nothing, is empty, right? Because then that would match right here. What if I did it? What would happen then? Anyone?
First argument.
So if I rerun this program, can I give it an argument and say Hamlet 3.1 without the G, and ask the number of columns, the number of lines, it does it, right? So this time, dollar sign 1 gets put into file, right?
Oh, y'all have a printout, right?
So let me get a printout. All right, so what that did is it did it and put it in the file in both cases, right? Any questions so far? Now, this is a newbie session. If you're new to shell scripting in any form, and any of this doesn't make sense, tell me. Okay? Then we need to verify the file. That's something to do later on. All right, now here's something new that we haven't learned yet in our shell scripting sessions. And that is the back quotes for the dollar sign paren. All right, so what does that do? Does anyone know? Any newbies know what this does? Any newbies? Are there any newbies to shell scripting? Do you have any idea what it might do? Okay, anyone else? Okay, well, what it does is whatever you have inside the back quotes, it will execute that, and the standard out of that, the output of that will be put into whatever you use. It'll be put in its place. Command substitution. Yes, that's what it's called. Thank you. Thank you, Rick. So, like what I did right here is I've got this wc-l $ file, right? So what this would do is this would do a word count the number of lines for file, right? Which is assigned up here, either from the command line or whenever it's prompting me. So this would do it would count the number of lines in this file. And instead of, and it would substitute that number into lines underscore file, right? Does that make sense? Well, turns out that the wc command, whenever you give it a file, as one of the parameters, it also puts the file name in there. That's not what I wanted, so I said, nope, that's not what I want. Alternatively, you could use the cat the file, pipe it to wc with dash l, and that'll give you what you want, right? But I didn't like that for whatever reason. And then here's another command substitution in bash, is the $ paren. It does the same thing as the back quotes. But does anyone know why you would not use it, or would you require you would use the back quotes and not Eric?
I would imagine it has something to do with the statement.
Yeah, I guess it could. Escaping? What do you explain further what you mean?
I just know that most of the problems I've ever had with JavaScript have to do with escaping.
That must be the reason. Yeah, you've got single quotes and double quotes that are or backslash quotes. I can't think off the top of my head, but I imagine there's probably yes. Like if you had something in your in what you were trying to do that had a back quote, that you have a problem with that. Yeah. So, anyone think of any other reason why you'd use the $ paren instead of the backslash?
No.
Okay. What's that?
Non-forking.
Non-forking? Is it? I didn't know that. That's awesome. It's non-forking. I didn't know that. That's cool. Well, that's a good reason to use it. See, you know, you teach and you learn, too. How about that? That's cool.
Well, what were you going to say?
Well, anyone else have any other before I reveal my reason? That's a good reason, I didn't realize. Anyone else? Anyone? All right, well, with this sort of non-pitcher, you can nest. So you could put, you know, if you don't know what file is, you could say $print echo file print, and the output of that would be file, which, you know, that's kind of dumb to do it here, but you see what I'm saying? You could do that inside of this $print, and you could nest more $prints inside of that. If you do it with this, the backtick, it'll go to the first backtick it sees and do that part, and then the next part it thinks is a command, and then the next part is something to execute. So you can't nest them. Or if you do, you have to do multiple variables or something else. Now, the backticks are bash. I'm sorry. They're born. They are inherited from born. So if you're trying to get something that lives on most platforms, then you're going to want to use this non-pitcher. But bash is also on a lot of platforms. So if you can, use it this way. And especially since it's non-forking.
I don't know. You'll have to ask Trace.
All right, thanks a lot.
I just thank you for
being here. Yeah, thanks a lot, Eric. All right, so now I'm introducing, does everyone understand then command substitution? Got it? Cool. All right, so now redirecting. Last month we discussed sending to an output using the greater than symbol. Now using the less than symbol, which is its complement, you can get file to be the input of this. So it's essentially the same as this. You see, I got wc-l $file, whereas this one I'm doing wc-l less than $file. This is the standard input gets sent to here and then prints it out. So whereas this one will give me the number of lines and the file name, this one will just give me the number of lines because it doesn't know what the file name is because it's a standard in as far as it cares. Same with this one. Make sense? Redirect standard in.
Is there any advantage to using the redirect in rather than catting piping in? Is there perhaps a forking issue when you issue the pipe? Does it actually fork that? And it doesn't do it with the
probably. Yeah. I mean, you've got a program running here. You send this standard out to this standard in, whereas this you just I don't know. But if you're writing bash or shell scripts, you're not interested in speed necessarily. So,
you should write a command optimizer and add it in the bash or something.
Yeah,
so like that.
Yeah, they did that for Perl, right? So you can do it. Yeah. All right. Everybody got it? Moving on. So now we got if test x true equals x $debug. If you remember, $debug is set up here. So if debug is true, if these two are the same, then this returns a true, which is what? Anyone?
That'd be a boolean.
A boolean, which is the return value from test is
zero.
Right, because that means zero errors. Zero errors, right? All right, so now notice, did I discuss this one time, the difference between the double bracket test and the single bracket test? Does everyone know? Does anyone care? You have an opinion one way or the other.
I would like to know the difference.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, I have an opinion. I'm not going to share it, but I have one.
Okay. So the single bracket test is the test program, which is in your bin directory, your binary directory. And so this will fork test, and test will run this. Whereas the double bracket is a bash built-in forks. I don't think it forks, so it's going to be, because it's a built-in bash, it's going to be running a little faster. The one thing you got to be aware of is that these two are slightly different, I think, if I remember correctly. So whereas this one understands that is equal to It also understands that double equal to be is equal to, right? And instead of the equal meaning assigned to be. But so, okay, so that's the other test, the bash built-in test. All right, so if debug is true, then echo the file has lines, file lines, all right? You understand why I've got the braces here?
No.
Now? You don't? Okay, last month you asked. Do you understand the reason why?
Well, yeah, somewhat.
See, now right here I've got, later on I'm going to be using a variable called lines. If I use the dollar sign lines by reading it, I'm not sure whether I'm going to have the value of lines with the underscore file appended to the end of it, or whether it's going to do lines file.
Right.
So now that I've got braces around it, I know for sure which one it's going to be. And so does the interpreter. So I got this first line in the file. The file has lines file lines. Alright? Cool? Everybody cool? Now. Alright, I'm lazy. I just didn't want to type what is the number of three times. So I just put, I just create a variable that says, what is the number of, right? Just a variable. Now, if test x equals columns x, this is one of the other ways to do test. And understand, I'm doing this with multiple ways that you'll see it. So some people will prefer test, some people will prefer double brackets, some people will prefer single brackets. This is the same as this one. This is the built-in test, right? Test will fork and then do its test. Now the difference you also need to be aware of is double brackets expects double brackets at the end. Single brackets expects single brackets at the end. Test doesn't care. Doesn't have anything out here.
As far as I know, bash has a problem with empty strings, so why do you use your x there? I test empty strings all the time, but it's great.
You can do that. However, if you're talking about using the dash Z option to test?
No, it's just, you can do, say, unequal.
Equal?
Yeah, and you can say equal, and do the test that way. You don't have to throw an extra character in there to protect against the variables.
Oh, okay. Well, I've always seen this hack, and it's kind of a good thing, because that way, if that works, right? I've always understood that
if some nuance that I was missing.
The thing is,
something to do with the variable not being assigned, if memory serves me correctly.
Yes. Yeah. If I didn't have the x here and columns were unsigned, then this would be if test quote equals
string equals null.
And then it would say where's a equals expects a second operand. So there's
right. Less. And I think the actual quotes protect against that. If you were to do it the other way and just not quote it,
and just stick
it there, like, and just that
oh, okay.
I think the quote protects against that.
Okay. Well, then do that, by all means. If I did it here, you mean. If I took the X off. Yeah, that would definitely, if the debug is not assigned ever, then this would fail because equals expects a right and left. And if this has never been assigned, there's nothing there.
So you're saying the quote would protect it, but not necessarily the correct.
Right. Right. If you don't have the quotes around it, then it won't catch you with that problem.
Yeah. Okay. I just do it all the time anyway.
It's a habit.
It's a hack that you see.
You mean you don't initialize all your variables? How language is this?
Well, now see, sometimes you use environment variables, and you go on a different distribution, and the environment variable doesn't exist. So you get that wrong. But okay. All right, so where am I at? Am I right here? What? Okay, test columns, then echo what? What is the number of columns on this screen? And then I didn't put this in quotes, and I put a dash n. So you want to know what the dash n to echo means? Yes, sir.
Does not put a new line at the end.
Does not put a new line at the end. So then this part gets done immediately. So. I commented that out and then added this single quote space single quote. Does anyone know why I did that? What on earth am I thinking? What, Jason? What's wrong with you?
Yes, gives you a space at the end of your line.
There you go. Exactly right. Gives you a space at the end of your line. Now, see, this is Using the echo with a dash in and something, and then a read comes, is essentially the same as read with a dash prompt, right? It's just a different way of doing it. You'll see it both ways. All right, so then I do the same thing here. Test lines is equal to X, and there I use the double equals for test. So test, do you understand the double equals? Okay, so anyway, read prompt, what is the number of lines on the screen? Puts it into lines, this puts it in columns. Okay, now we've got if debug. Now wait a second, Jace, you say. Up here before, I've got if test x true equals x dash and debug for my test. Now right here I've got if just debug. Now what am I doing here? Does anyone know? Why am I doing it differently here and here? Anyone? All right, so if you remember at the beginning, debug, I set to true. Turns out true is a program. True is a program that returns zero as its exit code, which means no error, right? True returns true, no error. False, on the other hand, is another program, its complement, that correctly exits one. It correctly exits error. Does that make sense? So if I were to set debug to false, if false, which would be one, if would skip here, right? So I'm just using the true and false program, and just whether it's true, if it's true, then I echo call equals columns, lin equals lin lines, just for debug purposes, right? Does that make sense? Everybody lost? Kevin?
Yeah, very much.
What?
Very much so.
Very much so?
Yeah, I'm half following it.
Okay, all right. Did you get a printout? You
got a printout? I did, I got.
Okay. All right, how many columns would you like to file to be in? All right, that's a future thing I thought about. For now, I'm just going to do two. You know, whenever you write a program, you say, hey, wouldn't it be cool to have this and that and the other? So I'm just going to put that in there later. Not like I'm going to go farthest away after, you know, I'm done with this session. All right, so now we've got here, I'm setting width based on, want columns to be two. All right, so that's just a variable I set. Otherwise, I was going to prompt the user how many do you want, and then there would be want columns. So if you wanted a three-column newsprint, all right, or whatever. Okay, so now I'm creating a variable called width, and I'm setting it to, well, now what is all this? Has anybody seen any of this stuff before? You got the dollar sign, paren, paren, blah, 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 paren, paren. All right? So you would think that where I just taught you that dollar sign, paren, paren, is to substitute the command and put it into there. This one's different. Dollar sign, paren, paren does mathematical calculations. So I'm putting in columns divided by want columns minus two.
Is that going to be integer based?
Yes. Integer based. I think because there was some confusion, this is my supposition, I have no basis for fact on this, but I'm guessing that because dollar sign paren means command substitution, that they also added this dollar sign bracket. So dollar sign bracket does the same thing. So if you want to do math in the shell, you just use either dollar sign paren paren, paren paren, and dollar sign bracket. And again, like I said, it's integer math. It's basically what you're probably used to seeing. All right, so next line, I've got dollar sign debug and echo call width equals dollar sign width. Wait a second. Ampersand is new. Anybody have any idea what ampersand does? Having looked at something similar to this in other programming languages, perhaps? Or know what the word ampersand is usually substituted to mean logically?
And.
It's an and, that's right. So this is a logical and. What did you say?
Both have to be true.
Both have to be true. No, that's not right. So, Does everyone understand what a logical ant is? Do I need to explain that? Newbies?
Sure.
Go ahead. You want me to explain?
Yeah.
Okay. A logical ant takes two things, right?
Truth table.
It's a truth table. Should I do a truth table? Boy, I'll listen. True and false. Sorry. This is the way I write it. I hope everyone understands. True and false. True and false. All right, so true and true.
True.
It's true, exactly. True and false. It's false, right? False and true. It is false. False and false. It is also false.
Yeah.
So this is your truth thing. So you have two things, true and false. Now, like C and other programming languages that are based upon C, and I don't know, there's tons of languages that do this. The born ampersand is a short circuit. Does anyone know what that might mean?
If the first command executes true, then the second command runs.
Right, and only if the first command executes true. So only when you have, well, if the first command returns false, you automatically know the answer. There's no sense in doing the second half, right? No sense in doing the second command. So that's the short circuit. If the first command is false, just go on. Don't do the rest of the line. If the first one's true, then you need to check if the second one is true or false. Okay. So what I've got here is debug, which is true or false that I've set up at the beginning. True, now it needs to test the second half. Echo call width equals width. You'll see this as a little hack. People shortcut this so they don't have to do the if-then-else, if-then-feed stuff. It's just a shorthand for the most part. You got to be careful, though. It's not exactly the same as if-then-else. If you use the complement to ampersand, and is the type, which is logical or. And or is just the opposite. This is or. So the true and false, and true or true is true or false is true or true is true, false or false is false. Does that make sense to everyone? Does anyone understand why that is?
Not exactly.
Okay. I have a shirt on, or I have pants on. True or false?
True.
I have a hat on, or I have pants on.
True.
That's this one. Reverse that. I have a hat on and a watch on. False. Or a watch on. I have either pants. I'm sorry. I have either a hat or a watch on. False. Right? Make sense? Okay. So that's or is also. It's also short-circuited. If the first item is true, it knows the answer is true, so it just skips. If the first answer is false, it checks the second answer for true. Okay? Or in the case of the shell, it executes it. Alright? Everybody cool? Didn't know you were going to be learning about Boolean logic, did you? Okay, so debug and echo creating file temps. This is just debug information. How are we looking on time? Okay, time to stop. But I'll just show you the format width, file to file.temp, right? So you saw me use format earlier. I said to the width that I say here, but it prompts me to put in. And then I take my Hamlet file, and then I put that to an output file of hamlet.temp. Right? Does that make sense? All right, we'll pick up here next month. Any questions with what we've gone through so far? Am I boring everyone to tears?
Send an email to the list explaining how to fix the cascading units of my incredibly filthy
script into just one purpose.
Well, we can do that at the end if you like, because I brought it with me.
Hey, real quick, what are the by type format so sort of brings something back in real quick? Show us that trick.
Oh, okay. Got here. Now we do do we do just the first line or the whole file or first couple lines or like that?
Do the middle paragraph, middle set of five lines or something. Just do something. Impresses.
Do the middle of it?
Do the middle of it.
So let's see.
Formatted to 10, whatever, 10, whatever.
Okay, colon. 10. 20, type it to format width of 10, and then page down, there. You want to do just one line, and do a bang bang, and does dot bang on that, that's them. Format width of 20, and then you say, you go down here, oh, I want this up here, so you join it. And then you do a last, and then that's what.
So you just did a bang bang, and put the dot bang bang on it?
Yes.
Okay.
So you do bang bang. Bang bang's quicker than colon dot bang for them golf.
While we're on the topic.
Of golf?
Of them.
Yes.
The other day,
to the right
I was on a system that didn't have nano, and I felt like I was going to die.
Wrong!
And so I looked up on Vim, and I hadn't used it in a while. But I went into insert mode, and as soon as I get any of the arrow keys to move around, it took me out of insert mode.
Yeah.
I mean, that hasn't happened previously. When I
is it Vim or is it VI?
Oh, it could have been VI.
Okay. VI did not understand arrow keys.
Really?
And if Vim is in VI mode, I don't believe it understands their keys either.
Okay.
So if it's strictly VI mode, you know how to move around elsewise?
If you use some of the
keys. If you put your right hand on the home road, J and K is down and up.
Uh-huh.
Left is H, right is L.
Okay.
So down, up, 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 left, 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 left.
Well, it would have been that big deal. It was on a Debian system. I could have had to get non-nano. But I was actually configuring the network, so I couldn't have to. Yeah. So,
Mark VI.
No, look at the Pico.
Hey, I'm just lucky I wasn't stuck in a system that only had
I would. All right, thank you for your time. And we are going to go to our... Does anyone have any announcements that they'd like to make while we're...
Yes.
Yes, go ahead.
A couple of things. I have a collection of 20 to 30 videos out of my car, and right now Jeremy's the only person who's volunteering to convert them from VHS to AUG Theora or something else. If anyone wants to do that, this is for Prevent Child Abuse Patient Scouting. They're lugging around the TV and the VCR to their meetings right now when they should be. And then they're already carrying the laptop, so there's no need to do that. The Free Linux PC Project has a ticket tracking system now. And a couple of things that we're doing with it. One is we're tracking internal things that need to be done. The second is because we interface with so many nonprofits, they are asking us for help with various things. For instance, we've got one group who wants a lab set up. We've got another group who wants essentially some CRM stuff. So if you're interested in that and want to take a look at the stuff that's available out there, there's not much right now, but it's going to start populating over this week. And so if you want to get involved with something really short and sweet, we can get your access to that, and if you'll just send a message to the list, I'll get you, I'll probably send a link to the ticket tracking system tonight or tomorrow. I have no one.
Great. Anyone else have any announcements? Okay. Well, according to my little email that I sent a while back, it looks like tonight our lightning hotness, our hotness lightning talks. Hotness lightning session.
Spending Paris Hilton over here.
Yeah, that's hot. So I had this idea. Someone said, "I'd like to see this and that." And I said, "Oh, I'd like to see that." I was like, "Well, hey, let's just have a lightning round. Show 10-minute something that you like, that's your hotness on your machine right now." And so a couple people said, "All right, I'll bring my thing and I'll show my thing off." That didn't sound right, but so here we go. Looks like Vaughn.
You want to either use that up?
I'll go last. Hopefully it'll get a little darker.
Let me see if
you want to move.
Or whenever it is I'm in order in the email.
Oh, that should sit there.
Yeah. That's your power.
You gave up the OLPC?
No, it's just an arm. I've never been able to display it. And, I don't have. There's no VGA out on it.
But I thought you were doing exit or secure shell, or something like that.
Yes, but the resolution on that is much more. I'm sorry. The resolution on my OLPC is much more than that one is. So whereas that's only 800 to 600, the OLPC is some
ungodly 12 to 80 by something. I don't know.
That's
fine. Got it all the way.
You know, it's a, yeah, for the display. But, you know, it's weird because it's such a small screen, you know. But the thing is, it's so compact. You set up and you put out
a 3X to restart and plug it in.
Okay. But yeah, it's so small that, I mean, it's, and I don't know why
right,
it is. If
they unplug something accidentally.
Projector only does 800 by 600. So if I were to do that,
lame,
I would have to scroll to look at the bottom and the top, and
you could need a different printer.
Beg pardon?
You need a different
printer. Nobody's suitable. I got an NVIDIA control panel up, so I can get you.
That'd be great. I mean, this is a Medions, and we appreciate them letting us borrow it. So, but they had to use it today on a session or their sales, right? So yeah, if you want to bring it from now on. Fantastic. So what you showing us, Vaughn?
Yeah, I've got a hat in my
little light up here.
Kill light. I'm sorry, what'd you say?
I had a nice little graphic, I think you're cool.
If you can see, real small.
I think that graphic may be larger than the screen, so it's not open.
I was going to do maybe what we set up at work here over the past year. We've gone from actually adopted a lot of open source. Went from a Cisco PIX router, put a pfSense box in, put one at a branch in Raleigh for I don't know who knows what. It's supposed to be sort of a newbie thing, but pfSense is an open source router firewall package, and I found it to be well ahead and above what we had with the PIX as far as ease of use and configuration. But we put that in there, and it did real well. And then we said, well, we had some problems with our old phone system, and so got Cisco to quote, several other local carriers to quote, and one guy came and quoted TrixBox, and I said, hey, I can do that. And we put TrixBox, which is asterisk, just in a wrapper, and now sort of combining everything together. The graphic I can't show you, or it's bigger than the screen, shows how everything in our office links together. But in Raleigh, we've got pfSense and TrixBox. In Greenville, we've got pfSense and TrixBox, and two buildings. They're all communicating with each other. Some of this may be something y'all have had for years, but for us, it was great to get three-digit dialing between branch locations and be able to transfer a call. A call comes into Greenville, they need a salesman who's in Raleigh. We just transfer the call, it goes out, pfSense routes it on its own T1. So it's just been, you know, it's my hotness in that it all works, and it's all been, you know, what Cisco quoted $90,000. I think we've got about a little bit over $15,000 invested. Most of that's just in phone hardware, and the rest of the operating system or the programming is all free, open source.
You said $15,000.
No, we've got about $15,000,
and phones.
We're talking about, I'm sorry, 1,500, you're right, 1,500. We've got, we have about 60 handsets. They were about $100 a piece on eBay, so that's 6,000 right there. We have three servers that were about $1,500, so that's another, so we're about in at about 16,000, I think that is a good number.
What kind of handsets are you using?
Polycom.
16,000.
Because he doesn't use string and cans.
That's just fine.
We've got the Polycom 501 is our bread and butter phone. But, all total. You know, I figure it costs a quarter of what we would bought on just hiring it out.
Did you do any special interface cards to interface with your phone provider?
We went Digium first and didn't like it so much. And I got
David, who's the other?
Sangoma. The A1, just a plain T1 card. And at both locations, and it comes straight AT&T comes out, and you plug it in, and away it runs. But
is that a point-to-point, or is that through internet?
It's just internet on, and it's not even the, and I apologize, I've had a long day, but MPLS, we don't even have MPLS circuit. But we are both on DeltaCom in Greenville and Raleigh, so the latency and the jitter and all that is no worse than the Nextel phones they were using before this came up. Most of the time, it's way better. So it is a pretty nice thing. This is the TrixBox. I've VP'd into our office, and this is the TrixBox thing. It's a
like I say, it's just a wrapper for Asterix and some of the other stuff that's out there. Flash operator panel, all sorts of other open source programs are just wrapped conveniently in this. The main engine, or the useful thing that I use most of the time, is just the free PBX portion of it.
Does it say Sugar CRM on it?
Yeah, it's got Sugar packaged in with it.
Oh, wow. One of the interesting things is from Sugar, you can have it set up so that you can dial a number and it will connect that number to your desktop.
We don't use
fully integrated.
Yes.
Yes. Wait a minute. So you pick up your phone and you dial and it goes to your phone?
No.
You click on an icon.
Okay.
And then your phone starts ringing.
I was like, wow, that's awesome. I can pick up my phone and listen to it.
Okay. So go to the web interface and click on the button.
That's a prize.
And it'll dial you.
It'll dial you and have that number.
Really want to get up to.
That's cool.
Indeed.
That's hot.
We don't use them, but we don't use Sugar, but there's also the way the inbound calls can pop up contact information.
Oh, nice.
You know, and automatically record it in CRM that, hey, this person called at this time. So your CRM records are more likely to be complete.
I went with TrickBox because I'm the only technical person in the building. And having a web-based thing that somebody else can have a password to, and most of it's just checkbox and you know, see what's happening. And
so when you go on vacation, they don't bother you?
in theory, but you know, that was my big reason is if I go anywhere, hopefully somebody can follow some instructions, even if I'm talking through it over the phone. But the free PBX is the main configuration portion of it.
That's hot.
But it's
did you guys just do a straight cut over, or did you demo it for a while?
Put up one phone or two handsets and put one in one corner of the building, one in the other. So you guys can you talk to each other?
Yeah.
Right. And then you know. And then it happened real quick after that, but we had a Merlin Legend that was dying, and we got to where just finding used boards and different things was becoming a heartbreak just to keep us up and running, so we were pushed into it.
You mentioned you have three servers, but they set up in a redundant cluster like you have servers.
There's one in Raleigh, one in Greenville, and we can have failover in multiple registrations, but I really kind of had a need. I probably ought to, but they're just...
One of my guys.
When you have a power failure or something.
Yeah, but...
Yeah, I guess that's we use call manager, and if we didn't have clusters,
now we if you lose power and all of his clients are in a single building, how are they going to register?
Well,
because presumably if it's
you can lose power to the server without losing power to the building. You can lose the power supply in a unit, you can lose hard drives in a unit. You can lose all kind of things.
It's old back. We've got a spare box sitting there ready to be turned on.
Okay.
And
it was more of a question of how you handle it.
Yeah, I just got to go.
I mean, our environment's much larger.
Yeah.
It doesn't really apply, but it's more like doesn't support redundancy.
Asterix and TrickBox can be clustered real heavily up there. The biggest thing, seeing somebody support 50,000, is that?
There are clusters that'll support that. They'll support any of the 50,000. They're doing an entire government department, multiple sites, all across the country, and so it'll find a PBX app for the thing at some point.
And like our phones can, if one goes down, we can
very quickly on the phone, change the registration to the other office.
Right.
Because I only got 30 phones in the building, and of those, only five were really important at any time, so I scramble when I have to, but I had a much more impressive uptime until it came up. AT&T has been digging holes in front of our building, and I didn't realize.
Hello.
When I got back from vacation, I said, the phones are down. So the first thing I did was reboot, but then I actually look out the window, and there's AT&T, and they had cut the line. But so I was uptime like 58 days before this, and that was just for a upgrade. But it's been up since we put it up. I don't know what all y'all want to see on it, but from our perspective, the stuff and work that's been good is the ability to transfer calls outside the building and find me, follow me for the salesman. They got one number now. They can go out and ring their home, their mobile phone, everywhere they may be all at once. So we're catching a lot more calls on the first try.
Did a bullet call back to go with them?
Yeah, you can, and you can voice attendant, and you know, if you want to go to voicemail, or if you'd like to try another number, go to a secretary, you can do all that.
Had you used any of this before you did this?
No, not at all. So, I mean, that's for testament that if I can do it, it's really easy.
And our asterisk at where I work, if there's voicemail left for you, it gets put into a WAV file and emailed to you. So you can listen to your voicemail from your computer if your handset's not glowing and you don't want it to tell it.
Yeah.
There's supposedly a package that's come out in the past 6 to 9 months that attempts to decode the voice recording to text. And it'll send the text along with the WAV file in an email, so you don't necessarily have to listen to the voicemail. Read it. I've heard mixed reviews. Some people say it gets about 90% accuracy. Some people say it's closer to 70.
But does it understand Southern accents? Does it understand Southern accents?
That's the 70%.
That may be in the 70%. Yes.
Without getting into a lot more technical. There's various voice protocols or data protocols to get a voice or IP call to you. Inside the office, it's SIP from the server to the handset. Office to office, it's IAX between the servers. But one of the neat things that we did, Digium makes a little IAX adapter, a little blue IAXI, they call it. And you just plug an analog phone into it, plug the other end into an internet cable, and you've got a phone wherever you are in the world. It comes back to our server. We had some guys go to a conference in Mexico, and we just gave them a $10 analog phone and that in their hotel room. I just plugged it right in. It negotiates past, or it's invisible really to the hotel authentication routines and all that. And they just plugged it in. They had an extension for a week and a half, and then right there, call their wife back in Greenville, just pick it up. All of a sudden, the number, they're in. So that was, you know, that was something made me look good. So
how much do they get?
$90.
Okay. You can get them much cheaper. That's the cheapest price that Digium allows people to tell you that they will charge. They have pretty severe. If you put something up on eBay, try to put PC up on eBay for less than, I forget if it's $90 or $99, you'll get nasty grams from a number of resellers and from Digium. I'm telling you, they don't know where you bought it, they'll find out and they will cut you off. But you can get it much cheaper as long as you're not trying to buy it over the internet.
You can try opening that graph off your Firefox directly and it'll auto size it down.
Oh, there you go.
EFSense?
Yeah.
Is
stuff. I'm really interested to see that.
Do you know if there's a soft fund for hazards?
There are many.
So we're looking at getting just an IP phone to go with the Wi-Fi for the guys in the warehouse. But we can't get them to answer the phone even when they're sitting there. So it's.
But virtually any soft phone out there,
you can add 11 megapixels.
Anything that does skimming.
There we go.
IX, sure. Gateway control protocol, like drop 23. Any soft phone, is that connection to that?
This is sort of what, in the past year, what we've thrown together, cooked together. The Greenville LAN up there at the top, you got the asterisk server just hanging off the LAN. The big pfSense box, that's our Greenville one, just not as far, I don't know why it's bigger, but we've got four NICs in it.
Emphasis.
NIC 2 goes to a DMZ, NIC 3, like I said, we actually have two circuits coming in. This is something we couldn't do with the PIGs, is depending on where we want our traffic to go, we route it on one T1 or the other. So I've got one T1 that is only for a VPN between locations. So with any VoIP traffic or AS400 traffic between the two locations, if pfSense sends it on its own little Python, that's all it's on it. When we didn't do that, we did have call quality problems. Somebody goes to sportsillustrated.com or something, the calls will drop or crackle. But once we put it on its own circuit, we wanted the bundled circuit to have three, but it works better just to split them.
Can you do QoS to help take care of those problems and not have to?
Not without going to the MPLS with our carrier. We can do the QoS all day long in building, but as soon as it hits the T1, the DeltaCom beta is stripped, so it doesn't do
anything. They had MPLS.
Yeah, they got it about the time we came up, but we really haven't had a reason to go to it. The call quality is really pretty good.
So the bandwidth there.
And what does MPLS stand for?
Multi-protocol labels.
That's sort of the summary. Anybody got any questions?
Describe your server hardware to run pfSense and run your
app. pfSense is running on $60 IBM NetBANAs we broke off. NetVistas that we bought from the FLPC program. They got a bunch donated from Alcoa. And
well, those were 2 gigahertz.
Two gigahertz. Uh-huh. 2 gigahertz, 1 gig of memory. We up memory in them.
Do you feel bad for taking those machines?
We bought them.
Oh, I know you bought them.
They stole them. But
I want to know if you feel bad paying for it.
Yeah, I go home and worry.
But no, we use 2 gigahertz.
Hitting them 4 or maybe 3, and we don't ever max them out. I mean, we don't, maybe 30% processor is the highest I've ever seen. The Astro Trick Box in Greenville, I started with the Dell 2650, which ended up being a real bad choice. The interrupts in the Dell BIOS are pre-configured in just certain, you only have certain choices for the interrupts and you don't have a lot of flexibility in reassigning them. And they just give you little patterns, you know, 7, 5, 9, 12 for your four devices, or you toggle it and flips them around a little bit. But there's, I believe that has been the problem
we've had the faxes. Trixbox can receive a fax and email it to you. And we were hitting probably about 95% success with that. But every 5% would just be half the fax or the top lines cut off and then just dropped. And it only takes one order to be lost for that not to work. So
can you get an analog line and just
They've got analog cards,
right?
And what we did is we just put our faxes back on analog and just stayed that way because we can't. The business is too competitive. We can't lose an order. You know, you always got the Cancun trip advertisements, but never. It would always fail on an order or something important. But in Raleigh for the Trix box, I bought the green box from Tonality. They're pre-loaded, pre-configured. And I noticed in setting it up that it is a lot of the buyer's interrupts are. You've got every choice in the world. You can reassign, and, you know, if you need this slot to have one interrupt all by itself, you can do that, no problem. It's it was about $500 cheaper than that Dell, and it's done as good or better. And it's just a little dinky little board, a high cooling case, and a little SATA drive.
Those are actually made by Rhino. They make all the equipment like for.
That's more or less a nutshell.
Great, thank you.
A little longer than I planned.
There's two of them.
Next we got David.
Which David?
Which one signed up?
Uh-oh. We've
got, that's you. Compass?
No, I'm not. This is me, but you're just going to get MythDB because they...
Well, no, wait, then that David data. Funk, Cobbler, and or backup PC.
Yeah, okay.
Is that you?
That's me.
Okay.
All right, I'll show you something really cool that my brother neglected to bring a computer. He was going to have Fedora installed. If someone brought a computer and wants Fedora 9 installed, I'll show up Cobbler real quick, but I'm going to talk through it. Maybe not get blinded. Cobbler is a framework that essentially sets up pretty quickly a PXC boot server and installs over PXC. You boot over PXC and it starts to install over the network. And you can do a base install in under 2 minutes on decent hardware. So, you know, by the time you've got your multiple CDs out or you've got a DVD and read from the DVD, and selected your packages, you'd already have it done. On top of that, it handles all the updates. So right now, if you go and say you want to install CentOS or RHEL, you grab the disks, and so you grab, let's say, CentOS 5.0, because you've already downloaded it, you stick it in, and it starts loading. You get it all loaded and installed. The first thing you do is -y update, and have it update the entire machine. With using Cobbler, it automatically is installing the updated packages rather than installing the base packages. So when you roll the machine off, it's already keeping your repositories in sync. You run a cron job to have it sync the repositories to keep the packages updated, and then it is installing the updated stuff. So when you install a machine, it's updated, ready to go out of the box. And you can use Kickstart to do this, and rumor has it you can do it with SUSE, Debian, Ubuntu, and a few other distributions that aren't Red Hat centric. We're using it, I'm using it at work, we're using it at FLPC, and we're installing about 6 gig worth of data, and it takes about 30 minutes on some really, really old hardware to install a machine from nothing. Everything, and it's repeatable. You're setting, you can create users in your Kickstart file. You can go ahead and set root passwords. You don't have to answer any questions.
It's going to install it. It's going to be repeatable. It's going to be the same every time, and you'll know that the machine's set up the same way every time. So you can hand off the task to someone else. And that's Cobbler. Any questions?
Awesome.
So you didn't say it's hot.
When the Cobbler, can you set it to where the Cobbler's hot? The Mac is it peach
cobbler? It'll push down a different image based on Mac.
Yes, you can have it. It'll push down different image based on Mac address, based upon IP address, based upon the class of machine that's connected to it. You can do interesting snippets, like for instance, one of the ones I have detects if it's a VMware image, because there are some things that you want with VMware, like you want certain kernel options to make sure your scheduling doesn't get, or your timing doesn't get screwed up, because when VMware is presenting that virtual CPU, you're not getting each of the CPU ticks. So your timing goes off pretty quickly. And one of the ways you can compensate for that is to put a kernel option in. So one of my Cobbler profiles checks to see if it's a VMware machine that it's loading onto. It's a VMware machine. It gets that kernel option automatically put in.
So that equals 10 when the clock.
I think it's actually 100 hertz or 1,000 hertz. And so you can toss in a lot of. Yes.
How does Cobbler know that the remote machine is a VMware?
It's looking at the hardware. Because essentially it's booting up and it's sending data back to Cobbler saying you're getting all of the syslog data that's coming across, and you're getting deep message that's coming across, and it's sending that back to Cobbler. So Cobbler's looking at that and it's saying, oh, there are X number of drives. I need to handle, when it has three drives, I handle it this way and partition it this way. Or it's on VMware, it has that VMware generic hardware. I know that I have to do X, Y, and Z because it's seeing all of that come across back to it.
Now, did you say the package updates get redistributed to everybody in sort of a BitTorrent sort of way?
I did say that, but I don't know that I understand your question. So,
in the same way that BitTorrent shares the file, a file among different people, it can look at all these other people's repositories,
yes,
what they've downloaded, and say, go away. Jim's is newer than Fred's is, so we get Jim's.
It will check. You can tell it what repositories to look at, and it will go out and check for updates constantly, and it will grab those updates so that you have a local repository for it. Okay. And then you can tell the machine to point to that repository in addition to the distributions repositories, or you can have it just point to the... You can have it just point to the distro's repositories. But it,
what he's asking though is, can you update existing machines on the network? Like have a local, is that what you're saying?
I am.
Well, yes and no. There is a component called Cone.
Cone?
Cone, K-O-A-N.
Cone, okay.
No, it's Cone. And it will allow you to reinstall a machine. So if you have a machine up and you want to repurpose it, it will handle reinstall from the command line. You do cone, tell it what profile you want to hit, and it will automatically launch a reinstall.
Does Cone drop the user data for the purpose of the machine?
May. Depends upon how it's set up. And that can be a bad thing, but at the same time, if you're converting a file server with SAN attached storage to, say, a DNS server, you know, the SAN would preserve the data and you wouldn't have access to that anymore, but unless you had another machine mounted. But the machine itself could easily take over the DNS responsibilities. But to do what you're talking about, there's a tool out called Funk that a bunch of guys...
I'm sorry, it's called what?
Funk, F-U-N-C.
F-U-N-C, Funk.
Yes, but it has all the disco-esque meaning to it. As a matter of fact, if you look at their label, it looks like it was designed in the 70s.
We got the Funk?
And Funk is a distributed command system. Essentially, there is a certificate authority that exists, and it issues each machine a certificate, and it issues operators certificates, and it keeps track of. It acts as a centralized authority figure, so you can say Eric has permission to deal with all the machines in Greenville, but we're only going to let Kevin deal with the machines in Spartanburg, and we'll let Jace deal with machines in both places. And it's bi-directional. So, for instance, if you wanted to run Yum Update on 30 machines, Eric could say Yum Update Greenville.servers.enterprise.com, and it would update everything in that DNS hierarchy, all the machines in Star Greenville, so file server, DNS server, web server dot Greenville.servers.com would automatically get updated, because you can essentially use globs instead of shelling into a machine, running Yum Update on a machine. You can do it across probably, right now, the largest implementation I've seen is about 500 machines. So you can say, all the DNS machines, we want to change some configuration pattern. And you can change a file in single, in all the DNS machines, just as if you were doing it in one. And because it allows that bi-directional capability, and instead of authenticating to a single machine, you're saying, I'm sending this command, and here are my credentials, and that all those machines are saying, yeah, you have those credentials, we'll let you run that command, and you can go out a ton of machines. Any questions about Funk? It's a cool tool if you have more than about 10 machines and need to manage more than 10 or so machines. Nothing. Backup PC. Shameless plug. The August edition of Linux Pro Magazine has an article on backup PC that was written by me. So I urge you to all buy it and then write in and say that you love that particular article.
You crashed my system.
The guy's an idiot. Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm going to warn them ahead of time about you here.
I'm sorry, what's the magazine again?
Linux Pro Magazine. It's the expensive one.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
They want $13 for. Yeah.
But, which August you said?
August. It is coming out July 15th.
Barnes and Noble has it.
Barnes and Noble has it. Books a Million has it. Those are two I know about. Backup PC is a multi-platform, multi-transport, deduplicating, intelligently scheduled backup platform. It does not have features like backing up Exchange, backing up databases live, things of that nature. It's assuming that you're going to use native tools to do those backups, and then it's going to grab it. It's primarily designed to do disk-based backups. And so, looking at it, it's multi-transport. It'll do backups over SMB or CIFS. So you can, without having to throw a client on, you can back up your Windows machines. It'll do rsync. It'll do rsync daemon. It'll do tar. It'll do any of those over secure shell. And so virtually any type of machine out there, you can back up one way or another. Some of the interesting things that it allows you to do is it deduplicates your data. So I back up, for instance, 30 Windows machines. Those 30 Windows machines, by and large, have the same data on them. Even when you're getting down to documents, I've got three users who are doing the same job, and they happen to have the same reference manuals as PDFs on their machine. So rather than backing that up three times, it says, you know what, the file name for these files is the same. I'm going to hash that file and see if it is the same. So file name is the first test. If file name is the same, then it hashes. If hash is the same, then it keeps just one copy and places hard links in both of the backup parameters. And let's see, what else did I say it was? Intelligently scheduling. Most backup programs that you set specific times for them to run. You say backup server XYZ at 10 p.m. at night. Well, that doesn't work so great, especially when you're talking about laptops. There needs to be prioritization. You don't know when people are going to be in. They may be on the road for 2 weeks at a time and then come in and only be here for 3 days. So the way the backup PC does it is it looks on the network by default it's every hour. I have it set every 30 minutes. And it says, show me all the machines that I'm responsible to back up and let's see if they're there. So it runs, trying to see if those machines are there. By the way, tell me if I'm running out of time. It checks to see if those machines are there. If those machines are there, it then says, all right, who are the machines that are here that I need to back up? And you know, if you backed one up an hour ago, you're not going to start another backup. So it sits there and it creates a list of machines that are here that backups are due for. Then it's going to prioritize those. And it's prioritizing based upon a couple things. First is the last time that it saw the machine. So if you've got a machine that hasn't been seen in 50 days, and you've got a machine that's been seen 10 days ago, the 50-day ago machine is going to get backed up first. Although it does multiple backups at a time, the default limit is 4. So if you've got 4 machines or more, you're going to start running into where it's going to try and schedule intelligently based upon how long ago it's seen. It'll also say, you know what, I've seen every time that we see this machine, it's on 24 hours a day. It learns that. And it will it'll say, you know what, I can put off backing this machine up because I know it's going to be on at midnight. And so if there's another machine that, even though I haven't done a backup recently of that machine, the backup is older of the other machine, I know it's going to be on, I'm going to push that off. And so it's intelligently scheduling, and that's a pretty cool feature when you're dealing with end users as opposed to servers that are on all the time. Let's see, talked about deduplicating, I talked about multi-transport. It's cross-platform, so it runs on Windows, Linux, Unix, Mac OS X. The final thing that I like is that it's end user accessible. In other words, your end users can do their own restores. There's a web interface that allows them to go and look at the file system, look at the last time they were backed up, start backups. You can let them stop or dequeue backups as well. And having that ability, if you've ever had to deal with end users who mangle a file, lose a file, and they want your help getting it back, pointing them to a web interface where they go and get it themselves rather than bothering you, you having to dig out tapes, find the tape that it's on, find a non-mangled version on a tape. You know, that's a lot of work.
So this does full version?
Yes, it does full versioning. And as a matter of fact, if you use rsync as a protocol or rsync daemon, it will, it essentially does incrementals forever. So you can have, for instance, I keep two folds, which is really a falsehood. I keep folds forever, really, and I check checksums on the files as they move forward, so that I only am transferring files that have changed. That is a neat fold when I'm checking the checksums. And I will check, I just check in time on files during incrementals. So it's really incremental forever. It's got that one base once the first two run. So I'm backing up machines with 15, 20 gigs of data, and they back up in 30 minutes.
Are you backing up the whole machine or just the data on the machine?
I back up the entire machine.
So, and this duplication of files, that works over the system files? And
yes.
All of that?
Yes.
Wow, that should give you a significant savings.
We initially projected that I would need 7.5 gig backup of around 40 machines. I have not yet hit 1 gig.
That's awesome.
Well, for instance, you have an ISO sitting on your drive. You're backing up 600 meg of that ISO. If I've got five other people that have that, and I'm only backing it up once, I've saved almost 2.5 terabytes worth of data.
But it doesn't
2.5 gigabytes.
But that file doesn't have to exist in the same directory.
Not in the same directory. It has to have the same name.
What's the cost of this program?
It's free. It's open source. Okay. It's back at the PC. It's been around for about 8 years now. It really has not gotten a lot of press because it's been disk-based. And really, disk-based backups have been very expensive because disk has historically been expensive. But that's changing.
If you run in a small company, though, that's the only way to go.
I mean, it is.
It has been for years now.
Yes. Yeah. And quite honestly, if you're backing up the kind of stuff, until you can start justifying a huge tape library that's going to sit there and change it, how do you back up 5 or 10 terabytes worth of data? So we've been using this for about 6 months where I work. We've been using it a little longer than that, but it's actually been in production probably about 3 months now. For everyone, we've had progressively larger beta users, and we're extremely pleased.
A little while ago, I thought you said that you thought it was going to take 7 gigs?
7 terabytes.
Okay.
Terabytes, and I have not yet hit 1 terabyte.
Okay.
Sorry.
I kind of made that interpretation, but I wasn't sure I did it.
Yes.
But you said 3 flops.
I do that all the time.
You explicitly said floppy disk.
Yeah. Back on PC is floppy disk based backup.
Yes.
Are you jumping this to tape or hurt me?
As an 8.5,
keep everything on disk.
We are keeping everything on disk. We are talking about replicating it here at Medion for in case the end of the world, as we know it, happens in Liberty. And
not that you're dead.
Yeah. At that point, I probably don't care, but someone may.
When you come back, everybody was less than $200. Why would you do it again?
Yeah, I don't know. I can understand from an archiving standpoint. In fact, a PC does have an archiving standpoint. If you've got to keep something for 7 years, that may make some sense for long-term tape storage. But
I don't trust tape chapters.
Yeah, we're really trying to shy away from that. We'll do the tapes probably because lawyers demand it. We won't trust that for backups. That's the archival type.
Okay, well, that's...
The nice thing that backup PC does is it's checking checksums as well. So even if this starts getting corrupt and it's checking the source checksum, it's going to find out, hey, there's something different here, and make another copy.
Yeah.
So you kind of have a little bit of error detection that keeps up with things. Any other questions?
Yeah, oh. Easy just to back up the backup too, and
yeah. Let me show you. I'm gonna steal. Have already locked
up.
I've got the. He's got the web interface. This is my boss, by the way. Tell him really wonderful things about me.
I don't believe it.
I was really trying to withhold visual display to. Entitled by the magazine, which I've loved them. Ironically, though, they've already paid me for the magazine, so I don't get anything if you buy it, other than unless you go and tell them.
One question about the hashing and the hardware.
Sure.
Why would the file name need to be the same? The content of the file would be like it needs to be hashed, right?
Well, theoretically, if you were going to do. If you have unlimited amount of time, you could hash every single file.
Right.
But it's time and processor
longer.
Intensive. I mean, I've got, I'll tell you how many files.
So you're just saying that it's a trade-off.
It's a trade-off.
Okay.
This will also do compression on the fly, and I don't do that.
I have... how about the overhead? You're running this all day long, and somebody brings their laptop in and says that you haven't seen it in a couple of months. Is this going to Are they going to complain about your network being slow?
They don't complain about the network being slow. And
can you throttle plans?
Yes and no.
Wouldn't matter anyway unless it was network.
Well, it does because the client feels it.
Especially if it's a VM, that's our situation right now.
Or a wireless client.
Well, the client feels it more because they're getting all of this disk access.
That's another point too. But slowing down their system is what I'm saying. Is that a problem?
It is initially. And what we have typically done is on all of the new clients that we're pushing out, we do the backups first. And we get two full backups. And after the first two full backups, it's no big deal. You can, let me jump into a client here, see if I can find mine. Actually, mine's a poor example.
And how often are you actually doing these backups? You're checking every half hour.
I have it on a, currently the schedule is backup every 2 days. And then check the checksums every 14 days.
Why do you do two full?
I'm sorry?
Why do you do two full? What does that mean?
Getting the two full will register a checksum of the head end and tail end of the file. And so when you're going back through the file list, it's looking at two things. It's looking at end time, and if end time has a change, it also checks the head and tail end of the file checksum to see if it really has changed, regardless of what end time says. Modified time. There's end time, A time, and C time, modified time, access time, and create end time. But you can see here, this is a pretty large client, and his last backup, which was an incremental, was 48. Checking all the checksums, bumped it up to 71 minutes. And that's, once you get past the first two folds that most people aren't seeing, I don't see it. Do you see? We have some complaints from the really heavy users that are doing a lot of disk-based activity as well. But when you're talking about 20 to 50 minutes.
But if you're only doing it every 2 days, I assume you're scheduling it in off hours anyway, right?
Well, not all these machines are here. I let the backup PC schedule it. When it sees a machine and, hey, I haven't seen this machine, it's time for a backup of this machine, I'm going to kick one off, and it starts it.
Is it smart enough to prioritize the off hours?
Yes. If it knows the machine's going to be there in the off hours, because it's learned that through history, it will not back it up during the day.
The issues don't seem to be the backup itself, but the comparisons that go on for the checksums.
Yes.
And that can be, we get a lot of feedback from our users, not a lot, but some, that that's a problem, especially people that have tons and tons of small files.
Or badly defragmented disks, or badly fragmented disks, I should say.
So, but I understand
when it's badly defragmented.
I believe there's supposed to be a new version of rsync out that's going to cut that significantly.
Yes, there is supposed to be the latest version of rsync that has been released. It's in alpha right now, I think. I think it's still alpha, maybe beta. Cuts the checksum checking by. It is 1/8 of what it was the version prior, processor utilization.
Which should solve many of their
risks. Which should drop that. And by the way, we've opted to go rsync simply because of the incremental forever. It's not passing all the network traffic for all these files that we already have a copy of.
Explain that. I'm not familiar with that term.
The concept is that you do a full, and then you're constantly checking against that full to see if something's changed. And so even though you're running a full backup, which in this case is only checking checksums, you're not really dumping all of that data back across the network. It is, it's really an incremental. It's only passing what's changed, even though it's verifying that everything's the same on both sides, instead of just comparing a modification time. Our new create time. And that saves you on network traffic, saves you on disk access to a degree. You still have a disk.
So what you have is, what you wind up with is a synchronized file system.
Yes.
With version.
That's, yes.
Okay.
When there's a change to a file, it grabs the whole file, it grabs the building?
Right now, it grabs the whole file. The newest version of rsync, which is an alpha, is supposed to start doing deltas. Although, quite honestly, network traffic is not. If you look at the network traffic that we're talking about at most 4 megs a second. That's what 32 megabits a second, and that's on a switch network. So that's not pushing things.
That showed last night backup, right?
Yeah, and 1.4 megabytes a second.
That's my machine. I was working on it at 6:30. I had no idea that was going on. I didn't know it backed up tonight until I saw it.
The people who are complaining about this are certainly our power users, and we have a pretty heavy technical crowd because most of our users are developers.
Well, I got people who will complain if they just see their drive line running. I mean, it doesn't matter this one.
Unplug that lead. But you can see.
Can you take it up to real time backup or redundancy?
No. Well, I mean, it's not a DRBD type solution. You can schedule it for, I guess, every few hours. But you can see I've got all of these machines, and it's color-coding them. Because we're doing incremental forever, we're backing up the actual size on disk would be 1.6 terabytes. If you come back and look at, by the way, I apologize if this is a Windows machine. I haven't yet converted into.
Interface looks great, just need some retouching on that bottom bar.
Yeah.
The Linux box. Two boxes. I don't know how it works.
My pool is 661 gig. So I'm not even close to touching
So that's how many machines?
This is around 40.
And most of those being Windows or Linux or what?
Virtually all of these are Windows. There are a few Linux boxes out there like mine's machine.
What kind of data are you talking about? I'm surprised you don't have more of that data on the network instead of on the individual machines.
One of the things, that was my argument when they told me they wanted to implement a laptop backup plan. I said, you have no purpose in having data on your laptop. And I was told that that was well and good in a textbook, but that users were going to put data on their laptop. And part of the reality is that our people are mobile in excess of 50% of the time.
That's it.
So, right now, over our WAN, there's just no option to have them push big files back and forth. We've got people with terabytes of data that they're pulling chunks off and putting 50 gigabytes worth of images on their machine to work on at a time, and there's just no hope of them using a server because they're just not in the office. So reality sunk in that telling people that was essentially a problem for the company because they weren't going to do it. It wasn't reasonable for them to do it. And so, I guess I have to live with that. But if you take a look at, show you the, you can, and the user can do this as well. They can start incremental or full or stop a backup. But you can also, come in to a and let's see if we can change the show history. You can come down here and it will show you when. Here are the backups, the last set of backups across here, and when something changes, you'll see a V0 for the first instance, and it'll come across and show you the versioning. So a user can say, I don't remember when this file was last right, and I don't want to go mucking around in your machine too much. Is there a safe place I can go where there are likely to be versions?
Look for your check.
Payroll.
No. Look under data off the C drive.
Okay.
And if you want, you can go to WOTD. Look at consulting WOTD.
No, my videos.
Nothing in there.
Not anymore.
It's all on Tumblr.
No. Okay, you got a machine that the hard drive totally crashes, and you got to restore the whole machine. How easy is that? Is that as easy as if you had an image of that machine?
No, and it's not designed as a. It is a data dump, not a.
So I've still got to do my imaging.
Yes. You can see this particular VO version 0 existed across. All of those backups, and it maintained the same. On the 27th, it changed, so we have another version. On the 28th, it changed, so we have another version.
What's the DR mean?
Where do you see DR?
Above that.
Directory. I'm sorry. Yes. Anything else?
It's such a cool version of the DI.
Yes.
DI, I like that.
I mean, it's not a document management system by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, if you've got a user who says, I need this document, and I don't remember when I last mangled it, you can have them just come up here and click, and for a single file, it'll pull it directly off the web server.
What model is that tiny little thing?
X61.
The
very lucky it is not blue screen.
and
it,
he's not.
It tends not to do that running Linux.
He's not being facetious about that. But it is a cool program. It's definitely, if you've got end user machines, it's definitely worth a look. I don't use it for server backups. I know a lot of places who do. The University of North Carolina does. But they're mainly a Unix shop. So
why not? Why wouldn't you?
Mainly because some of the tools that I would want, such as being able to hit Exchange while it's live and backup. Same thing with SQL Server. Because I'm in a homogenous environment.
The other thing is you'd want to schedule the server backups.
Even though I can do blackout periods, I wouldn't want it hitting 10 a.m.
You can't actually do hard scheduling with this?
You can. It's really not designed for you, but that ability exists. And the way that you would do it is you would tell it never to run to look for machines on its own, and you would tell it when to go look for machines. So you would say, start only look for machines at 6 o'clock at night and 8 o'clock at night, and don't look at any other times.
Can you have more than one backup profile?
Sure. As a matter of fact, per machine if you want.
Okay. So that would solve that problem.
I'm using Bacula right now for servers, and it gives me a little more flexibility. The default version of RSync doesn't support VSS out of the box, and although there is a version, and I do use a version that has VSS. Enabled, so I can.
VSS is what?
Virtual snapshot something. It allows you to take a stable image of a file, even though the file's open, even though there's a locked file.
Shadow copy.
Yes. Because of things like SQL Server and Exchange, I want something that is more widely supported on, so I need Bacula.
Is
this
a client? Aspect of that, right?
There is fine.
It is
just set
two.
All right.
I'm sorry, I had to be there. And now we've got Eric, who said he's got a 2-minute lightning talk.
All right.
And he better keep to it.
Okay. Usually log into a lot of servers. I use Vi to mess with the programs all the time. I always log in as root. I'm down like that.
This is what not to do.
And this guy right here is, he's a pansy. All right? I don't even mess with him. Pansy. Like David said, that's good for textbook and that's good to say.
You never need root.
Because, I don't know, mama's boy, breastfed, I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm a root guy. Anyway, go in, you buy a document, okay? And I'm on wirelessly, all right? And invariably, something happens to my wireless signal. My SSH dies, right? Everybody's had their SSH session close on you. And you're like, I wonder what kind of damage I did, right? And you've kind of got that uneasy feeling, and you need to go call your mom. And so what I do is I always install Detach. Does anyone here ever use Detach?
No, I use Scream.
Yeah. Scream.
Y'all use Scream?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sorry that y'all use Scream. Because Scream messes up emulation on half the machines I log into, all right? Detach does not.
Sorry, you're doing it wrong.
Well, I'm sorry, it's not completely right. Detach's ANSI codes go from A to B uncooked. Detach does not cook any screen codes. Okay.
Wait, are you using Red Hat?
I tell you, I get logged into a log machine. All right, this is Red Hat. Example here. All right. So I log in. The first thing I do is I do a detach minus A, and then I do a temp, and I do some kind of, I do my name actually, but we'll say session one. And then in batch. All right, so what that'll do is this will execute another, it'll fork another shell, and you'll get a pound sign again, or a dollar sign. And you'll be running batch, but the thing is, this is session one. The thing is, it creates a pipe here. This is a pipe file, which basically holds this process ID running in memory, so that your parent process, if your shell dies or the wireless gets cut, your parent process ID, PPID, is killed, okay? But your child process ID is still running. So your shell is still running, it's still going through a command that's running and doing all kinds of nifty stuff. But when you log back in, you get to another shell, that previous process is still running, you can type in the same exact command. And what this does is say, hey, I'm going to attach back to my pipe, okay, called session one. And lo and behold, the screen refreshes, and then you're back to where you were. So you do not corrupt your client's files, you don't risk losing data, okay? So detach is very, screen lets you jump from, you can have about three or four screens at the same time. Detach, much more simple, it's just one, all right? So you can't adhere to multiple logins, except you just log in again with another shell process, and you just say two, session two. Now, our accounting system's character-based with all our users. When they log in their Bash RC, this is the first thing that gets run in their login process is a detach with their name. They log in the accounting system. Well, their Windows boxes constantly crash. They get viruses. They plug up space heaters. It's the number one problem in the winter. Space heater, 14 people are down. 14! People allocate inventory, it's unallocated. You know, the thing, you know, I don't know what kind of database this is. You know, it's just screwing up the accounting system. So I'm having to rebuild files. Hadn't had to rebuild one file in the umpteen years I've been using Detach. So everybody detaches. And when they log back in, the batch process auto reconnects to their screen. And they're like, oh, that's where I left my order. I was in that customer. Okay. Now, the other utility I like is, search and replace. I did a lot of web development, and I wanted to search and replace stuff in a lot of files. And I learned this one from Google. It's called Perl, P-I-E.
So I remember it's pi, easy as pi. All right. So now I'm going to do a search global replace. Okay. Now inside, this delimited by forward slashes. Now I always remember this. This is how I start off on the command line. And what I need to do is I need to inject the string here in here with my text I'm going from. So I can convert B to B.
Is that not a string or a regular expression?
This can be a regular expression. Okay, but I'm going to be easy example. I'm just going to convert the word B to B. And I'm going to do star.html. So I'm going to change all of my web files, HTML files in that directory. I'm going to change it from B to B. So every web file just got changed. Okay? Or let's say I need to do an, let's say I got an image source equals quote forward slash blah 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 to image source equals forward slash another directory. Okay? So what I need to do, and I need these quote signs, the reason I write this out first, not padding real spaces visually, is because I need to get back in here and I need to escape out these forward slashes. Alright? So when I inject that regular expression into here, I better know that I'm escaping that those forward slashes out on my path. And then Perl, nice search and replace. So when I'm changing about 3,000 files with the search and replace, I want it to complete. Why? So I'm going to make sure I run detach first. So I'm safe. And then I don't care how, by the way, this takes a second. Perl is really awesome. I will know that this will complete whether I drop the connection or not. Sometimes my commands run for half an hour, okay, the other utilities. So I will start my process at home. I will go ahead and just X out of the shell process. I will get back to work. I will log in, detach back in, and it's still running. Okay. So search and replace and detach, that's my lightning. Thank you, Eric.
I'm doing MythTV and CompTIS Fusion, and you'll please to know that I won't be doing CompTIS Fusion because it doesn't behave very well with MythTV. Like, it completely nukes the box. The problem is actually I use NVIDIA X. Well, I'll get to it in a minute. Before you consider MythTV, you have to consider hardware. You're going to have a tuner card, and almost nobody has a tuner stock in their PC unless you have an ATI All-in-Wonder. You can get that to work with MythTV in the same sense that I can amputate one of my limbs, but that doesn't make it a good idea. I would recommend look at the IVTV package. I'm running a POG. I don't know why they spelled their company name that way. Looks like it should be said Hopaj.
It's the Hopaj River in New York. The city.
Can you spell it for me, please?
Yes, because it's on the remote.
How do you spell?
HAUPPAUGE.
Oh, is that how you say it? Hopaj?
Hopaj.
Oh.
I'm running a Hopaj PBR 250 and works beautifully with the IVTV drivers. And in general, when you're looking at buying a tuner, if you're going to get an HD tuner, go to pchdtv.com. They make a Linux HD tuner, and one of the glorious things in their FAQ is, do you support Windows? And it just says no, and that's the end. They only have drivers for Linux. It's basically a small production card that they make once in every while, and they sell out pretty quick because they're only $100 for an HD tuner card. And you'll want to avoid a lot of the USB tuners like you'll see on Woot, Pinnacle, HDTV to go, blah, blah, blah. A lot of that crap doesn't work. Avoid USB if you can. And you want to take a look at the remote. In specific, you want a remote that's got some extra buttons on there because Linux will let you program those buttons to do whatever in the world you want, and they are bloody handy. And in fact, I'll bring it back. That is actually the KDE infrared kicker is what they call it. It's a little monitor that's running in KDE, and you can configure any button on your remote to launch anything in KDE and do anything in KDE. MIDI TV, not particularly pleasant to set up in most distributions. That's why Mifubuntu is like actually fairly up there in DistroWatch. It's a tremendous pain in the butt. And MIFTV is the reason that I left Mandrake Linux 10 back in the day and went through like the better part of a dozen distros before I got to Gentoo. And laughably, Gentoo, the hardest Linux distribution there is the only one that makes it super duper easy. After I installed MIFTV and Gentoo, it was like literally three commands to have everything up and running. Whereas like the Fedora guide's like, gee, it's like 6-10 pages, it's crazy. Sorry.
It's okay, we got real jobs, that's all right.
It used to be you could get your TV listings from free from labs.zaptuit.com. They don't do that anymore. They claim it's because people are abusing the service. I claim it's because they're totally mismanaged and incompetent. Now you have to go to schedulesdirect.org. They're a nonprofit. It's $15 for a year's worth of listings, but if you compare that to how much listings are for TiVo, that's a bargain. $15 is what, a month or two in TiVo for listings? Anybody have a TiVo? Anybody know what TiVo is?
Yeah. I got the lifetime to
the side. I think I paid $5.
But one of the benefits to MIFTV is a lot of it's been built out modular, so you can separate the back end from the front end. You can have a little box in your closet that's got a bunch of tuners in it, running TV, and you can stream it over your network to any other machine. In terms of what you want in terms of hardware, you can get by with a half gig of RAM. You're going to want more. If you're running just the front end, you can get by with 256 megs of RAM. Don't expect to be doing anything else while the front end's running, though. And you're going to want a good GPU, preferably NVIDIA, because NVIDIA, I know it's not free, blah, blah, blah. NVIDIA has something called XVMC, X Video Motion Compensation, and it makes the TV look really, really good after you can it through your GPU. And one last consideration you want to make when you're buying a tuner, you want a hardware encoder, that is, or a hardware decoder. That is very, very important. If you don't get a tuner that has a hardware decoder, you will be destroying your CPU just to play back the TV stream. And something like 1.5 gigahertz per stream if it's a software encoder, it's crazy. Whereas if you have a hardware decoder like my card, it's like 1% CPU, it's nothing.
What's the card again?
POG TBR250, Google IVTV. Anything that the IVTV driver supports is a good card.
Get one on Newegg for like what, $100?
That's where I got my POG card on Newegg on eBay for three years ago for $80. Okay, we'll go ahead and go to the watch great TV very much, but as you can see it's got a pretty powerful recording system. You can schedule, like you can set priorities, you can set how long you want to start before time or after time. You can go through the program listings. I mean, it's very versatile. And aside from Charter's really crappy quality in my house, it's pretty good.
So that's your signal that you're getting?
Unfortunately, I'm like, that is at the tail end of like five or six splitters. So.
Can you show us something you grab from this?
Yes, I was going to say, that's the other thing. It doesn't just do TV. There's a lot of plugins, including obviously video, music, image gallery, game, so on. And one of the little tricks I like to do is the video plugin is nothing more than sort of like a database of a folder you point to on the hard drive. So take Miro and save it somewhere within that folder, and you can sort of have MIFTV sort of aggregate all the video data you're getting through Miro and podcasts and whatever. It'll integrate real nicely. And go to the see, there's the podcast right there, and
let's see, let's go back.
This is an iPod. We had this room on 2008.
And that's M-Player playing, but the remote control works for M-Player, Amarok, XMMS, Audacious, a ton of stuff.
Griffin at his new Vista security tool.
What was the actual name of the title of the talk? The actual title, actually, literary, is How Could I Poon Be? Let Me Count Your Ways. So, obviously, that was
SmoothCon. And tons of plugins. If your distro is out of date, you'll have MythTV 0.20. I feel sorry for whatever your distro is. A lot of the MythTV specific distros are really out of date. If you have MythTV 0.20, you're going to find a lot of the plugins are simply broke, because later on in that branch they started working on 2.1, and as things broke, they didn't fix them. They're like, sorry, you're just going to have to update. Yeah, it's got music, image gallery, let you see here. It's oddly enough, I never got M-Player VLC to play a DVD complete with titles properly. I'm sure there's like some really ungodly long parameter list you have to put in to make that work. It just works with MythTV. It'll show all the DVD menus, and the controller will work with them. It's great. But I'll just start again. But yeah, I'll take you to where you can manage your recordings, schedule recordings, and search words, keywords. So yeah, you can search. You knew it was coming. You can search for whatever you want. It's MySQL. Look how quick it searched through all the listings of anything that's coming up. It's a MySQL backend that's pretty quick. And you can sort through, and you can set all the recording options. Here's what I told you, see, record this showing, title, week, every week. It's ridiculous. It's actually got more options than the TiVos that I've played with around. And one last word of advice. Most people have a converter box because they have the digital tiers and the cable or whatnot. There is a serial port on the back of the Charter Motorola converter boxes that is designed to work with PVR software like MythTV. And before you go out like I did and buy a $20 USB to serial adapter and then Dremel the screws off of it because it doesn't have screw holes and it's flush, don't bother. Charter intentionally disabled the serial port on all their converter boxes, and they will not sell you one that is enabled. Sorry. And basically, if you call customer service and bitch, they'll say, sorry, we can sell you our PVR system on the other hand. And so, I mean, you're screwed. Sorry.
I think that comes every time. Screw you over every time.
Yep, the only thing you can do it's for people who don't know what I'm talking about, it's the same problem you have back in the day with your VHS. Your converter box wouldn't tell your VHS, or your VHS wouldn't tell your converter box what channel to go change to record. So if you recorded something on different channels, it would stay on one channel. And you get the same problem with the tuners because they don't go into the triple digit channels, the digital tiers. The only solution around that is an infrared blaster, which is filthy, dirty, and unreliable. I mean, all it takes is, you know, your pet moving the infrared blaster, and then suddenly you're not changing channels anymore. Question?
You just put a small mirror in front of it. It works fine.
A mirror?
Yeah. There's also the blasters that sit right in front of the IR sensor on the cable box, so that, and it is adhesively affixed there.
The RF, the transmitter interrupt. So it's either RF thing on the side.
No, it's
IR, but it's RF. So you don't have to have anything.
You're putting the IR transmitter. You're attaching it to an IR board, and so you're actually hitting the IR header pins.
Oh.
What the heck are you talking about?
But,
IR stands for infrared. It's part of the spectrum. Infrared, ultraviolet, radios,
physical.
Most of the serious people I know with MythTV just end up going with DirecTV because they allow you to play nice with their boxes. The only other thing we should consider if you're going to get a with TV set up on your own system, storage. Live TV recording eats, I want to say, about 2 gigs an hour, two and a half gigs an hour.
Can you change quality?
Probably, but just standard NTSC is two and a half gigs an hour, much less if you're pushing
aging.
How long to convert it?
I mean, can you transcode to MPEG-4 on the fly? Is it fast enough to do that?
That machine isn't, that's for sure. That's a Pentium 428. Maybe if you got a, you know, smoking fast modern system, but I doubt it. It does have a unofficial third-party plugin called, like, MythWeb, and it allows you to transcode and push stuff across the network to your Myth front end instead of streaming it natively. And if you are going to stream it, you're going to want at least good wireless G reception. If you have even mediocre quality wireless G between the front end and the back end, give up. It's going to sputter like, you know, stop motion style. You're going to want wireless in or to just be wired straight with most stuff. And in terms of transcoding, big beefy CPU, but to transcode a college like football or baseball game on this machine out to XVID at medium quality, double pass and doing all the denoise algorithms usually ends up taking me 3 to 4 times longer than the actual game run, so it'll take me like 9 to 12 hours to transcode a football game. Yeah. But this is a somewhat older machine. Question?
Did you say that this thing can act like a sling box? So you can work some programs at work?
Pretty much. I mean, well, it works only if you have a ridiculous upstream on your home connection. Which,
define ridiculous.
You're not going to want Charter 6 meg with like 60K up. That's not going to hack it. You're going to want a lot more than that. Even if you're pushing low quality stuff across the network, you'll eat bandwidth in a hurry unless you really transcode it down to something like it was Real Player in 1999 on dial-up on some website.
That MythWeb thing, that converts it to Flash, doesn't it? I've heard you can watch Myth recordings over the internet via Flash.
Not sure. I think that may be one of the output options. I could be wrong. Most of the transcode output options are standard old-time codecs, MPEG, XVID, things like that.
I thought I heard something about DirecTV not having FireWire ports and that being somewhat essential in a MythTV setup.
I'm not sure if it's a FireWire port. Most of the converter boxes, it's a straight serial port. And there's the actual software within MythTV to control a converter box, I won't lie to you, it's not elegant. It's filthy dirty. It's like raw Perl scripts, but it works. And I'm pretty sure all of it's serial port stuff. But of course, if you're around here and you're on Charter, it doesn't matter how many serial ports you have, or even if you dribble the screws off of them like I did, it won't work.
You dribble the screws? Dribble the screws off of the converter box or off?
No, not off the converter box. Off the connector. The connector had the screws that are permanently in, and the serial ports flush on the back of the converter box. And so, yeah, that was fun, flying little metal pieces.
How did they disable it? Did anybody?
Probably literally. They said, hey, Motorola, you know, as many units from Motorola as they're buying, I'm sure Motorola said, oh, sure, we'll, you know, disconnect that pathway or not solder this. Or there could very well be a simple setting in one of the chips that says, no, you can't. Depending, this is a slight tangent, if you have an NVIDIA graphics card, take a look at NV clock, which is normally used for overclocking. If your GPU is one of the ones that was like one off from the fastest model at the time, odds are it was the fastest model GPU coming out of the fab. It just had a slight defect. And so they sort of disabled a few things and clocked it down. But with NV clock, you can cut that stuff back on. Yes. But of course, you sort of void your warranty, and if it crashes, they'll laugh at you and say, well, we told you not to do it.
I like that on the 6000 series of video, you can use like Read the Tuner to unlock pixel shaders and things like that. I had one with 12 pixel shaders, but it actually had 16 on the card, and you could unlock it with Read the Tuner.
That's actually a 6600 GT in there.
Huh. Well, yours probably already had a little 16 unlocked, because I think I had a 6600 regular, and had, I think it had 12, and I could go to 16.
Yeah, the Imagine was a little cheaper because they skipped on the brain. It's only got 128 megs of video RAM, but plays Doom 3 great. Doesn't play stuff in Sedega that great, though.
You said you were running off that too, but you didn't mention Ubuntu?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's called Ubuntu. It's an Ubuntu variant that's got the TV sort of pre-installed and configured and friendly.
But then you later bashed the distro, is it?
Yeah, they tend to be out of date, and especially if they're out of date enough to be running 0.20 branch, a lot of plugins can be just totally hosed.
What you got there?
Run that version? Zero, that's a SVN of 0.21.
You have to excuse Jeremy, he's a Gen 2 beta, like some of us are.
Actually, no, I'm not. I've had, this laptop was running Gen 2, and for those who are listening to Sourcecast, the little podcast I started doing, that's now running Orange.
Orange?
Arch. Arch.
And that's a Slackware variant, right?
That's just a Slackware variant.
Not really. It's like Gen 2, only without the compiler and the use flags. I would still keep Gen 2 on the server because the use flags are just so damn powerful. But I concede it's somewhat impractical on the desktop, but it was the only one at the time, way back when I got into Gen 2, where Myth TV wasn't like performing a root canal on myself. And back then, a lot of the distros also didn't gracefully upgrade between releases. So every 6 months, I got to redo the 10-page setup guide all over again. So you can see why I might have moved to Gen 2 at the time.
Have you seen this guy's, or something where he's put together like a whole package that I think it actually incorporates Asterisk and they would like automate your home, you know, alarm system. It's got Myth and everything all packaged in. You ever play with that at all?
No.
I've heard what he's talking about.
I have to go around with it. It's pretty, the guy put a lot of effort into it.
So for those of you who like sort of the concepts behind Gen 2, which is rolling release, a lot of software that's potentially bleeding edge, take a look at Arch. I really like it as a desktop, actually. It's not that bad. And one of the things I particularly like the most about it is how cool this is with my laptop.
Wait, this wasn't on your...
I didn't do Compass Fusion, though, because it's not within the TV.
But technically, it's an AMOR
Compass. Drop it.
But I know there are a lot of GNOME fans in the room that, for whatever reason, don't like the look of KDE. But and I know this is going to look similar, but
Simon says work. Simon says restart X.
I shouldn't. It normally works because it's big fan. Well, apparently I still have some configuring to do in Arch. But I was going to say, in Arch they have something called KDE mod, which is similar to how KDE is in Gen 2, where it's modular. You don't install the whole big thing. You say, give me that, give me that, give me that. And it is the most beautiful looking KDE I have ever seen stock. It's integrated. It all looks great. And even all the GNOME people, they're like hardcore GNOME fans, that when I show it to them, they love it. It's beautiful. It's excellent.
Four or three?
Right now it's three, but they just released their last rev of three. And if you're in Arch, you can actually go to their KDE mod 4 SVN, if you're insane. It is still unstable. Basically, Gen 2 and Arch took the same position on KDE, which is KDE 4.1 will be the first release we'll offer to you that isn't like marked as unstable, that you don't have to go out of your way to install. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
As an aside, kind of a commentary on Lightning Talks, we had the gentleman who is now the lead release engineer for Gen 2 come and try and show us a merge world. And hoping that it would be done in his hour and a half presentation.
Emerge may not be around that much longer, actually. Pollutus is getting so incredibly popular now. And who can blame you? If you have a well-used Gentoo, for those who don't know, the software manager in Gentoo is called Emerge or Portage. And it's entirely Python-based. And the problem with that is once you get a well-used Gentoo system, it has to go reading thousands and thousands of files to figure out what you have installed and how to upgrade and so on. And so, like, when you say Emerge Update World, it would take, like, 60 seconds of thinking. And Pollutus is written entirely in, I want to say C, maybe C++, and it caches everything. So when you say Pollutus Update World, it's like, bam.
Spell Pollutus, please.
P-A-L-U-D-I-S, and it's not just for Gentoo. They have it for you. You can install it and play with it on other distros, too. But that's not the funniest name. Arch has a third-party software manager, too, and I swear to God, nobody in this room could pronounce it. Y-A-O-U-R-T. I just call it yogurt. But it's really great because Arch has something called AUR, Arch User Repository, where anybody can submit a build, and it will go looking in AUR if it doesn't find what you're looking for. And it'll say, hey, I found this. Do you want to install it? Yes, done. Yes, Pac-Man is a stock, and yogurt is a third-party thing that it's getting pretty popular, actually. I mean, I love it. I don't use Pac-Man anymore. It has all the same syntax as Pac-Man. It does all the same things as Pac-Man, only more and more friendly.
And Pac-Man's that little game with the little white yellow guy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, we're going
to try it with
live
pointers.
Okay.
Now, what is Pac-Man?
Pac-Man is the package manager, for Arch.
Okay. Because I'm thinking Pac-Man is SUSE repository, which is not.
But since you're the only person in here that's that maybe still has Gentoo installed even, try Arch. You'll probably like it.
Sorry, did you say it's the 11.11 that hasn't been installed?
No.
No.
Software for non-Wussies. Sorry.
Wow.
Are you trying to start a flame war?
On my podcast, we just reviewed Ubuntu, and my co-host is a Debian developer in New York. And while I thought I had some curious things to say about Ubuntu, I thought it was okay, but didn't sort of reach towards the crown of the best user-friendly distro, but it could have done more. He had some really nasty things to say because
this
he was
a Debian developer.
Yes.
The most un-user-friendly distro ever.
You clearly have never installed Gentoo if you think it's the most Okay, the Gentoo handbook is like 30 pages. Great learning experience, it's painful to install.
You're a friend of the guy who's got PRG of OpenSSL.
Nick. No, he has some legitimate beats. A lot of them do with development because he dabbled in Ubuntu Devil for a while and had things happen like the Ubuntu devs broke libc and your system wouldn't boot anymore if you were playing around with the Devil branch. And they completely nuked sound from the kernel in the Devil branch.
Who? I did that. I updated one time and my sound completely disappeared.
Yes.
And I would boot in one kernel, it would work, and I would boot in another kernel.
Exactly. And he had a whole bunch of stories like that of, you know, brainless stuff going on in Ubuntu Devil. I mean, who in Ubuntu Devil is playing around updating the kernel system? We don't need sound anymore.
Well, at the same time, if you ever play around with Debian, unstable, or...
I profess ignorance towards Debian. I've never used
that. That's asking for a kernel. I mean, any distro's develop branch is going to have problems. So, going into develop branch, you're going to have problems.
Yeah, he was understanding that his beef was more of how incredibly boneheaded the mistakes were. making your system completely unbootable, certainly whoever made that change should have at least tried the package they created.
Well, you know, well, they do buy it, so at one time it's stable. And I mean, they actually, they did that, and they released it out to the stable package repository, and they had thousands and thousands of users kill their X server, you know, within a day.
I like Canonical, I really do. You probably find my sort of beef with Ubuntu more practical. I want to see a rolling release in Ubi distro where you don't have to go through a long process between releases. You just updating like an Arch to do.
If you see how Debian is testing it, you can do that.
Yes, but that's not newbie, is it? All right, then.
Okay.
And ease of access of getting non-free stuff. I understand the Richard Stallman rant, but I still want to be able to install Skype. If you hand it off to somebody who's never used Linux, and Richard Stallman dances across your screen and says, here's what you need to know before you have MP3 support. they're not going to be too happy using that distro. And I thought Ubuntu could have done more like Skype. I had to go to Ubuntu.
Right.
And I'm like security paranoid. I want it to be an official repo.
Why not? Skype, you can turn on their commercial repository. They have an official commercial repository where they have a bunch of non-free packages. In fact, it's in the sources.list comment down. Or if you go in their little GUI.
No, the third party, I enabled third party stuff in there. Skype, Google Earth, and a whole bunch of proprietary stuff is in Medibuntu. Trust me, I know. I posted on Ubuntu forums and got, charaded for saying, oh, it's not official. I would have wanted them to have made it easier. Again, in Gentoo, if you install Google Earth or Skype, they're on the main mirror. You just get them. You don't have to go through any nonsense of adding another repo.
Are you trying to infer that Gentoo is newbie friendly?
No. I'm just trying to say that they're more practical about making stuff easier to install. Aside from the whole use life. I know it's a big thing.
What I like about independent repos like Adobe, they'll give you your repo file for Yum, and you can get Flash and Adobe Acrobat, and you know who you're getting it from. With the distributed repo you're talking about,
yeah, exactly. Ah, and that's one of the things.
I don't think I'd like Google Earth to be hacked up by this guy over here.
Exactly. That was my concern about the Ubuntu repository. And that's what I like about Gentoo and Arch. Gentoo is on the main mirrors, and Arch, AUR, user repository, you can see it fetching from the official source.
Can you understand where they're coming from, though, with the business perspective of that? Is that a lot of these packages
are not
legally allowing them to repackage.
I totally understand that, but I mean, why make everybody go search for it and go add a repo? Why not just say, during the install time, here, do you want support for MP3? And then you click yes, and it gives you a little pop-up saying, blah, 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 okay, and you can install it anyway. They could make it easier, is what I'm saying.
As far as MP3s, that has gotten world better over the last, year and a half. If you do a brand new install of Ubuntu, open up Amarok, open it.
That's just my classic act of habit example. Google Earth, Skype, you name it.
Okay.
Wow, I expected it to be a whole bunch worse for hammering Ubuntu.
Well, thank you very much. That's cool. All right, has anybody got any questions on anything else? Shall we adjourn?
Free monitor, good home, minus the speakers.
I'm glad all y'all new guys came here. This is great to see so many new faces. The dues are $10 to me before you leave.
You lowball that so much.
So this is Linux U Script. Come back next month and we'll see you, and y'all have fun.